Welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. This is your host, Andrew Vitelli, senior editor of Energy in the Americas for InfraLogic. Today, I am joined by Arash Shojay, a partner at Australian investment manager, QIC. Arash, thank you for joining Crossroads.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to see you again.
And it's great to see you. Arash, can you tell our listeners a little bit about QIC and the firm's infrastructure practice?
Sure, Andrew. QIC is an institutional investment manager and uniquely also a sovereign investor with roots in the Australian market and the Queensland region in particular. We've been investing on behalf of clients globally for more than 30 years. Today, we manage $86 billion of assets across five asset classes: infrastructure, private credit, real estate, private equity, and liquid markets. In the infrastructure team where I sit, we manage about $27 billion of assets. That's across about 21 separate investments. And we've been doing this in the world of infrastructure, Andrew, for almost 20 years. Clearly, our origins in the Australian market and deep roots in that region, which was a champion of infrastructure privatisation several decades ago. But over time, our portfolio has come to represent what is an increasingly dynamic and expansive universe of infrastructure assets. And we can get into some of those elements as we talk today.
And Arash, I understand you've been at the firm for about 13 years. Can you tell me a little bit about your background and what brought you to the world of infrastructure as an investment class?
Sure, Andrew. Well, I would say as far back as when I was in high school and university, I really liked engineering and science and the mathematics. But I also had a special interest in business and economics. And infrastructure for me was really the way to combine those two elements into one career path. Infrastructure being big, heavy, lots of physics, chemistry, mathematics behind these phenomenal engineering masterpieces, and on the investing side, of course, being able to critically think about them, their prospects, their risks. So after university, I moved into the world of M&A in Sydney, doing infrastructure, what I would now describe as traditional infrastructure, being power generation, midstream, you know, toll roads and things like that. But as you could appreciate, and as we'll touch on in this conversation, over the last 13 years, those traditional infrastructure sectors have started to take increasingly backstage roles to what's becoming a much more dynamic and fluid universe of infrastructure.
I do hear that a lot from professionals in the infrastructure space, that they like to be in an investment class that has assets they can touch that are actually there rather than only dealing with companies. So that is interesting to hear. And you mentioned you spent 13 years in this asset class. I think I've been covering infrastructure as an asset class for going on 9 years now. And as you mentioned, over that time, the asset class has really changed. And I really want to dive into that in this conversation. So to start high level, Arash, how do you think the asset class has changed over the time that you've been working in this sector?
Andrew, it's such a deep question. I recall in my early days in the 2000s, there was a lot of fascination with the world of infrastructure in that traditional sense. Like I said, midstream, gas assets, transport assets like airports and ports. And the attraction to the investor universe to these real assets was intrinsic characteristics like inflation protection, stable cash flows, yield, and effectively their role as ballasts to overall portfolios. And these are clearly very valuable elements in any portfolio construction strategy. I'd say as time moved on and capital increasingly became attracted to these elements and into the infrastructure universe, there were elements of expansion in alternative or new, maybe non-traditional assets and sectors that still represented, if not all, the majority of these same characteristics. And I think in the late 2000s, maybe 2010s, we started seeing what I would describe as the first phase of convergence, and that was the convergence of private equity and infrastructure. where assets were still capital intensive, still had an element of stability attached to them, but a lot more growth oriented. Over time, we started seeing this concept of a build to core. Over time, we started seeing a new entrance into the world of infrastructure, renewables and digital being examples where in the very early days, I remember talking about wind farms and there was a lot of skeptics. A lot of people were wondering how you could support a sector that was heavily subsidized and whether heavily subsidized capital intensive assets could in fact qualify as infrastructure. Now, of course, we've got the benefit of hindsight and we can delve into that. But I'd say that first phase of convergence of private equity and infrastructure was the first example of the non-black and white definition of the world of infrastructure.
When you talk about infrastructure, it's nothing new that there are investments that some people might see as infrastructure, others would not. I think even before I was covering the asset class, there were examples of investments that made people scratch their head. But do you think the asset class has become too expansive in definition in recent years?
I think like any trend, many trends historically, especially in the finance sector, the pendulum always needs to swing to an extreme before it recalibrates to an equilibrium. And I think there are areas where the infrastructure market has maybe overstretched its definition of what qualifies as an infrastructure investment. I am an optimist. I think that is healthy to find a boundary. That boundary needs to be tested. And I'd say renewables and digital infrastructure, data centers are good examples where in the early days people weren't sure about that qualification as infrastructure, but you know, over time they've been welcomed, even embraced with an infrastructure portfolio. So I think it's a healthy testing of boundaries, even though there might have been some misses over the last decade and a half.
And what about the risk profile? Are we stretching into types of investments that traditionally would not fit the risk profile of infrastructure? Is that a risk there, that these LPs in particular are investing in infrastructure funds with one perception of risk and it doesn't match the reality of the risk profile of infrastructure investment in 2025?
Look, I think that's possible, but I wouldn't over-amplify that possibility. In many cases that I have witnessed, GPs are fairly honest about, you know, where they're pegging their investment theses and strategies, and many, if not all, are honest about the risks that they intend to expose their funds to. And I think in all cases, I would think the LPs are aware that in the hunt for higher returns, those grey zones of infrastructure definitions may need to be tested. Now, again, Andrew, look, there might be some outlier cases where a GP or an investment team or an LP is stretched too far beyond the comfort zone, but I think that these would be rare cases and no signals of systemic issues.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I doubt that there are many cases where GPs are going to their LPs and saying, yes, we're only investing in toll roads, and then going way up the risk spectrum. I guess my thought is, when you look at infrastructure as an asset class, I think one of the reasons that it became so popular, that it grew so much, was the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, and investors looking for a really stable asset class. And we haven't really had another similar situation like that since then that really tested all investment classes in the same way. And I'm just curious what's going to happen next time there is that moment, whether there's going to be the same type of performance through infrastructure that drove that kind of investment.
Yeah, I mean, Andrew, you've hit the nail right on the head. It's easy to take risk in good times. It's only in bad times where we figure out who's really exposed themselves to excessive risk. I don't disagree with you. I think as history has taught us that there will be cycles, that there will be shocks to the system, and it's only within those shocks that the resilience, a key characteristic of infrastructure, the resilience of infrastructure investments will become apparent. Like you, I'm curious. And when we get to that point, we can have another podcast and chat about what we see in the market as part of that recalibration.
Hopefully no time soon. Hopefully the relatively good times will continue for now. And then how do you navigate that? How does QIC navigate that? The need for demand, the more expansive nature of the asset class than in years past, and the need to stay within what makes infrastructure attractive. How do you navigate that in your investment approach?
Maybe we are a unique case because of our legacy and our genesis within the arms of a government shareholder. We are very, very prudent and disciplined with downside protection. I would say on the spectrum of the infrastructure definition, which we try and stay as close as possible to what we think about as foundational elements of infrastructure characteristics. I do think one byproduct of this disposition has been a recurring investment theme or strategy at QIC, and that has been this idea of tackling convergent spaces. As I mentioned earlier, infrastructure and private equity have been converging from the 2000s. That's a high-risk convergence, but there are other convergences. The convergence of infrastructure and real estate is one that we've thought about, we've debated, we've thrown around, we've tackled together, only to conclude that it is a convergence space with a stronger risk characteristic for our capital. So maybe to answer your question directly, as the definition of the asset class, the infrastructure asset class expands, there are elements of that expansion that are actually very positive for risk. I'll maybe just give this a bit more shape through an example, Andrew. I can't remember, maybe it was 6-7 years ago where we started throwing around this concept of nodal value in our discussions at QIC. Nodal value or locational values is the idea that infrastructure assets sometimes, many times actually, demonstrate their value through their specific location and or their node within a broader ecosystem or network. And we'd seen this happen in mobile towers, of course. You know, petrol stations, they're not exactly infrastructure, but they demonstrate the same concept of being a part of a broader system, broader network. And we kept on thinking and rethinking, where else can we apply this? This nodal value, locational value of infrastructure became an example of the convergence of real estate and infrastructure in our minds. I would say we were fortunate enough to be one of the first to champion the cause for powered land. Even the word powered land, you can see, just combines infrastructure and real estate elements into one description. And as a result, we commenced a strategy in the US to acquire powered land. We've been doing that for 4 to 5 years. And now we have in our portfolio one of the largest, if not the largest, portfolio of powered land in the US. A perfect example of that convergence.
Well, why don't we define powered land? What do you mean when you refer to that?
Powered land is really any parcel of land or real estate, if you like, that has connectivity to the electricity grid. And initially we suspected, now we have all realized that connectivity to the electricity grid is tremendously valuable, that it is not a given like it has been for decades, that interconnection queues have been nothing but increasingly congested. And today, data centers are falling over themselves trying to get access to the electricity grid. And so if you deconstruct the value of certain assets, in this case, data centers or renewables, if you deconstruct their value, you find that a huge element of value actually sits in that grid connection.
That's interesting. And that is one example of convergence. And when we talk about the shifting asset class, I think you're right. There is more interconnection between private equity, private credit, infrastructure, and real estate than there has been in years past. And I think maybe that's a little bit of a natural evolution. And a lot of that has to do with data centers, which you mentioned. I think data centers have some characteristics of real estate and some characteristics of infrastructure. How have you approached the AI revolution and the need to build out data centers? How do you view that as an investor?
I think the AI revolution, AI evolution for us is two things. One is it's the latest chapter in what we see as a digitization megatrend that's undeniable today, and we think that will continue. Secondly, we do see it as a manifestation of this power and digital convergence, this infrastructure and real estate convergence. At this stage in the cycle, I would say we are cautious on the broader trend, but fairly proactive on ways that we can access that trend through the energy second derivative or third derivative, if you like, of the primary trend. That's our biggest focus right now.
So data centers are an obvious example of the blending of real estate and infrastructure as asset classes. Are there other ways that QIC and other infrastructure players are finding opportunities in these intersections?
Maybe the best example is an example that I find in North America is not as common. And that is our strategy to look at the interface of energy infrastructure and critical minerals and precious metals. Because as you and the listeners are aware, that there's a huge amount of interest in data centers and AI, but maybe not as prominently voiced is questions and concerns even about the supply of critical minerals to the Western world. And to a even lesser extent, I think, concerns about increasingly indebted governments and the value of what we call a gold hedge in infrastructure portfolios. Now, this is very much, I would say, a convergence of the world of infrastructure and the world of mining. But maybe again, to give it some shape with an example, some years ago, we invested in a platform called Pacific Energy in Australia, who provides remote energy solutions to remote communities and mines. It's the assets are energy, the traditional infrastructure, as you can get, the supply of energy. But a lot of the risk elements actually linked to counterparties that are mines for precious metals and critical minerals. And so if you believe the thesis that over time, the value of gold will increase because of inflationary pressures at a macro level, or if you believe that critical minerals and the supply of these under a China plus one policy is going to gather momentum, then an investment like Pacific Energy and this energy interface into the mining world becomes quite precious, the structure portfolio. So it's another example of how we think about interfaces and convergences while we build our infrastructure investment strategies.
Well, that's interesting. We've spent a lot of time talking big picture, but when you look at the U.S. market, I think that one of the most interesting stories over the last few years has been within infrastructure, has been energy investment. And there's been a really big shift, I think, in investment approach to the U.S. energy sector. You go back 3 years, it was about ESG. It was about how everybody wanted to invest heavily in renewables, renewables platforms. And traditional forms of energy were, if not undesirable, there was a risk that if you bought a gas-fired plant, let's say, you might not be able to sell it in the future. And investors were a little bit shying away from that. I think that's really changed over the last year and a half, 2 years. We've done a lot of episodes on this, so I won't go too deep into my thoughts. But I'm curious how QIC has approached this shift.
I mean, first of all, the observations are clear. That trend away from what was once, you know, sustainability, ESG energy transition towards resilience provided by things like gas-fired generation is abundantly visible. As you know, gas-fired power stations, the prices and values ascribed to these assets have gone up 2.5 times just in the last couple of years. And we've got things like platform value in the world of renewables, I think, continuing to diminish. It raises two things, Andrew, that I probably want to say. One is, in a large market, and the infrastructure market is now extremely large, there is tremendous inertia. And that inertia does force the market supply and demand into extremes. And I would say that several years ago, 5 years ago, where the world of energy transition was, where the world of thermal generation and traditional energy was, we're at different extremes, and now that pendulum is swinging and each is moving the other way. A complete tangent here, but this year we actually at QIC, we built an algorithm using large language models to collect information from, you know, media articles, the internet, the World Wide Web, to give some a numeric reflection of this trend, and it is very interesting to me that these large language models and the algorithms we've built are clearly highlighting that this trend is likely to continue over the coming years. So that's the first thing I would say. But the second thing, Andrew, is, you know, when you've been in the world of infrastructure investing for more than 20 years, like QIC has, you just learn a couple of really valuable lessons. And one is that the world is unpredictable. We can never go all in or all out on anything. The enduring strategy is to be diversified, truly deeply diversified, and ensure we have exposures to different scenario outcomes as the world evolves through an unpredictable path ahead. What does that mean for us? It means that over the last 20 years, we've held gas pipelines, we've held gas distribution networks, we've held gas storage facilities, in fact, some of the largest gas storage facilities in the jurisdictions they operate, while we've been building renewable energy platforms, powered land platforms, energy transition platforms. At different times, we lean in and lean out of each of these, but a healthy portfolio, I think, has elements of all over time.
Well, that's interesting. And we talked briefly about the interconnection of power, data centers. A lot of the money is going into some aspect of that, either into the data centers or the supporting infrastructure itself or the infrastructure that's needed to power them. Do you think that could make the risks too interconnected? And where I'm coming from is when you look at how people are forecasting the AI revolution, the expectation is that it's going to need so much more power in the coming decade, year over year. But there are a lot of variables, and some people think that it could flatten out. Some people think that AI could become much more efficient where it needs less space in data centers and less power. Is there a risk that in investing both in the power and the data centers, infrastructure as an asset class is a little bit putting all its eggs in one basket?
I mean, Andrew, it is exactly the right question to ask. And the short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is definitely. One of the things that we obsess about at QIC is this idea of as sectors converge, as asset classes converge, risks become extremely complex. The interrelation, interdependence of those risks become complex. Portfolio construction is no longer going to be easy. You can't just put 10% of the fund in 10 different sectors and assets and call it diversification. What you just said, the convergence of energy and digital infrastructure or data centers in particular, means that it is absolutely possible that exposures that are long data centers, for example, and long energy supply or long regulated utilities that all rely on the same underlying thematic, that is the demand for power driven by AI, it is dangerously possible that there are excessive tail risks in those portfolios. So I think it's not enough time to really unpack what those risks could be and how they could interact with one another to lead to extreme outcomes. Suffice to say that with these convergences, investors need to be particularly sharp with how they think about risk and portfolio construction.
So you talk about diversification within asset classes, and obviously that's one factor. The other opportunity is regional diversification. Arash, how do you approach that? How do you approach finding investment opportunities as a global investor that's not only looking at one continent or one geography?
It's good to emphasize the importance of regional diversification. I think that's one of those golden truths that will never go away. Put all your eggs in one national basket or regional basket, and it's not going to end well. I would say the second thing is regional diversification requires two things. One is a comprehensive exposure and experience across jurisdictions and a very well trodden path of comparing and contrasting risk across regions. So as an example at QIC, you know, we look at investments across APAC, across North America and Europe, and on a weekly or once every 2 week basis, we come together to really compare and contrast risk across jurisdictions and think about things like economic factors, government policy risk, and maybe its effects, maybe its trends or sub-trends in the macro trends of digitization and renewable energy, to really pinpoint where in that global rubric we want to place our investment positions. And I'd say, look, it's hard as an Australian-based investment manager not to say a couple of things about the role of Australia and the Australasian region in portfolio construction. the strong Western links, of course, with backgrounds in common law and consistent languages, but also a vertical dimension into Asia and a adjacency to get economic and macroeconomic exposure into a fast-growing region, has really emphasized the role of Australasian market in global portfolio construction. And QIC is fortunate to see the benefit of that with investors today.
Well, Arash, I have to say, we've, I think, spent more time than we usually do on some of the risks, some of the potential pitfalls of the industry. So I want to close on something a little bit more optimistic. We are recording this in early December. It's going to be one of the last podcasts I record before the new year. It's almost 2026. So to close out, what opportunities are you most excited about? What trends are you most excited about looking forward to 2026?
Honestly, Andrew, we've taken a negative tone in this conversation, maybe, but I am forever optimistic about the asset class in the world of infrastructure and real assets more broadly. I do think this is a phenomenal vintage to get capital out the door across multiple sectors. Notwithstanding the risks of this AI revolution, one should emphasize that it is rare to have sectors which with such tremendous growth out. And so we are in some ways blessed as a community, as an investor community, to have the fortune of creating exposures to this mega trend for our underlying investors. In the world of renewables and energy transition, there is no question in my mind that over the very long term, the world will need to decarbonize. We will need sustainable sources of energy that are good for people, good for profit, good for planet. And so I think 2026 will present tremendous opportunities for investors to gain exposure to those trends. There are others I'm very excited about, Andrew, but we can keep those to a separate conversation as the list is long.
Well, Arash, we covered a lot. I think we took probably a deeper dive into just the value of infrastructure and the role of infrastructure as an asset class than we usually do. But I think it's been a great conversation. And thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Andrew.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning into Crossroads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast player. And please give us a 5-star rating so others can find our podcast. Until next time, this has been Crossroads.